Hopes and fears surrounding the lifting of COVID restrictions are very much to the fore on your front pages this morning. The Irish Independent leads with the line that the return of non-contact training for children and golf and tennis for all ages are under consideration if transmission of the virus falls significantly before the 5th of April. For its lead story, meanwhile, the Irish Examiner reports on how residents of nursing homes are to be allowed to receive up to two visits per week from the 22nd of March. In common with the story in the front of the Irish Times, however, that paper also reports that although the 5 kilometre limit and restrictions on construction are expected to be eased on April the 5th, the easing of other restrictions appears unlikely following NPHET's warning that the situation remains precarious after 592 cases of the virus and 10 deaths were announced yesterday. Professor Philip Nolan is quoted in the Times saying that he's concerned that this may be the beginning of something. We are sailing very close to the wind, a gust of wind in the wrong direction, and we're in real trouble, he says. The Taoiseach's move to seek a meeting with the chief executive of AstraZeneca amid concerns about the number of vaccines the company is likely to deliver by the end of the month generates the lead story in the Irish Daily Mail. For its lead story, the Irish Times reports on the statement issued by Davy Stockbrokers last night, saying that the company has hired the international investment bank Rothschild to find a buyer. Frustration surrounding the failure of ministers in the north to provide clarity about when all primary school pupils will be back in school provides the lead story in the Irish News. While the Belfast Telegraph leads with warnings from Stormont executives that a full return to school could be delayed if people flout COVID rules on Mother's Day or St Patrick's Day. The Irish Daily Star leads with yesterday's discovery of skeletal remains by Gardaí in Drogheda, County Louth. The search was taking place as part of the investigation into the murder of a 17-year-old boy who was killed in January of last year. For its lead story, the Irish Sun reports on comments made by Aintu leader Padraig Tobin in the Dáil yesterday, calling for an investigation into allegations that junior prison officers at Portlaoise Prison made threats against a senior officer in October 2018. Although a number of prison officers and prisoners, including convicted murderer Freddie Thompson, were interviewed, no action was ever taken. The Irish Daily Mirror leads with a report on a funeral which was attended yesterday by 300 mourners in Carrick on Shannon in County Leitrim. And finally, the Examiner runs with a picture on its front page this morning of sisters Frances O'Neill Ahern and Amanda O'Neill Coyne. In advance of Organ Donor Awareness Week later this month, the two sisters are featured since Frances successfully donated one of her kidneys to Amanda in December. And Amanda tells today's paper that she regards her sister's donation as the best gift of all time.
If we stay the course, there is the prospect of a good summer on the way. That was the message from Dr. Ronan Glynn at NPHET's briefing last night. But with COVID case numbers averaging more than 500 daily and the R number, the rate at which the virus is increasing, still somewhere between 0.6 and 1, NPHET's chief modeller, Professor Philip Nolan, warned that we're sailing close to the wind and that a gust of wind in the wrong direction could see us in real trouble. Professor Philip Nolan, good morning to you.
Morning, Anya.
Where we're at, what's positive, what's concerning to you?
So in one sense, we've made extraordinary progress. We've gone from 6,500 cases a day in early January to 500 now. We've gone from an extraordinary situation where we had over 2,000 people in hospital with COVID to around 350 now. But I think we need to, because those initial figures are so extraordinary, we also need to remember in terms of those case counts, 500 a day, we're at twice what we were in December, 50 times what we were as we entered the summer last year. We've the same number of people in hospital now as we did at the peak in October. And we've almost twice as many people in intensive care as we did at the peak in October. So we've made this extraordinary progress, but we need to focus on the fact that the prevalence of the disease and the impact of the disease remains very high. And that leaves us in a place where we're making progress, but we're in a very precarious position. We're also at this delicate point where we're beginning to attend to and reopen our priorities, non-urgent healthcare and schooling. And this is not the time Unfortunately, this is not the time to relax in any way around the public health measures. This is the time to stay home. This is the time to only leave your home if it's for essential activities. This is not the time to have mixing between households. It's not the time to be going back to the workplace if it's not essential that you do so. And it is a matter of weeks that we need to exercise this care as the vaccination program continues, because that is the... There are two sources of hope right now. The first source of hope is that over the last 10 weeks, we have been successful in suppressing an extraordinary wave of disease. And the second beacon of hope is we've over 380,000 people who've received their first dose, 150,000 people who've received their second dose, and that program is accelerating.
All right.
So we need to stick with it, and this virus will exploit any chance we give it to come at us another time.
Let's break some of this down. First of all, you've told the government, haven't you, cases need to fall below 200 a day on average to ease restrictions significantly.
There's a range of metrics. One of the important things about the numbers is you have to look at them in the round and you have to look at them in context. So there's a range of metrics in the government plan. Yes, around the case numbers. More importantly, about the reproduction number, as to whether the epidemic is shrinking or growing. The state of the vaccination program and the situation in hospitals. So that's why, as I outlined, a simple metric like case numbers being 50 or 100 or 150 or 200 alone would be a poor basis on which to make the decision. The government has the right set of parameters in the framework, and we're not there yet for the further types of reopening. Our focus right now should be on making the reopening of schools work by the rest of us being exceptionally careful not to spread the disease while that's going on.
How is the school reopening going in terms of outbreaks?
Very well, right through, and it's a testament to the work. Schools are not necessarily intrinsically safe environments. They're safer, they're low risk because of the measures that principals, teachers and public health doctors have put in place, the mitigating measures. And throughout the pandemic, we have seen no evidence of the opening of schools driving the pandemic, and we've seen very little evidence of transmission within schools. And even though it's very early days, we have had very few cases reported. There's only 6 outbreaks just opened, and very few cases associated with each outbreak. And even when an outbreak is declared, that's usually not evidence that there's been transmission in the school. It's usually evidence that the disease has been brought into the school by more than one person. So very well.
But that's going very well so far. But as you say, mm-hmm. we're at a delicate tipping point. A gust of wind could put us in the wrong direction on this. So let's deal with a couple of issues. You know about the calls for more people to be able to attend funerals or church services at Easter, that golf, tennis, non-contact training for kids from April, these are all things that are being discussed. Is that reasonable or premature?
So... a couple of things. The first thing is what does actually concern us? What concerns us is that as things begin to open, it's not so much the opening of that thing itself, it's the signal that we all read into it. I mean, this is very hard on all of us. It's a very long period of lockdown. It's going to continue for further weeks until we're closer to the disease being under control. So the first thing that we're concerned about is, for instance, around the opening of schools, the increased mobility and tendency to return to the workplace and increased social mixing that occurs around those, not the opening of schools themselves. And that's true into the future. The second thing I'd say is the vast majority of citizens in this country have made extraordinary sacrifices over the last year. 52 weeks of this, where, for instance, people have lost loved ones and had to managed their grief almost on their own because of the restrictions and the number of people attending funerals, for instance.
Yeah, we heard about that from the Irish Hospice Foundation yesterday, and it is heartbreaking. And the question people are wondering, are we living with these restrictions till we're all vaccinated at some point in the summer, or is there the prospect of easement? Given what you're saying, you don't sound so sure that April's going to be very much better than March.
I completely agree. People close to all of us have suffered this extraordinary grief over the last year. And what I worry about is that if we rush, we've had 52 weeks of this. In 10 weeks' time, we'll be in quite a different scenario. 10 weeks after that, we'll be in quite a different scenario again. And I worry that we might literally squander the sacrifice of thousands of people over the last 52 weeks if we rush to do things too quickly over the next 10 to 20 weeks. So it's not that nothing can happen until everybody is vaccinated. That's not true. And for instance, there was the step forward yesterday around increasing visitation in long-term residential mm-hmm. care because of the impact of the vaccine. So I think the way to think about it is the vaccine program is ramping up really quite steadily. And as more and more people get vaccinated, there is more that we can do in the course of that vaccination program. Yes, there are some things that we're going to have to wait until we have population-wide protection before we can do them. But there are other things, priority things, that we can do sooner. Those priority things are around human health and services, education, outdoor activity, and so on.
So the prospect, if we do stay the course, if we get through this delicate tipping point that you've been describing where we're at the moment, and we manage to go on driving the numbers down, that as the vaccinations, and we hope it'll be a million a month, don't we, from April on, as the vaccinations kick in, there is the prospect that this will ease, you know, yeah. In the months ahead, April, May.
Yeah, I think Dr. Glenn put it very well last night. I mean, we've seen this before where quite understandably in a long period of restrictions, you see a kind of a level of slippage in the population. We get tired. We get lonely. We find it difficult. We mix a little bit more, each one of us, just a little bit more than we were 2 weeks ago. You can see the impact of that and the spread of the virus across the entire population. And when we see that collectively, we pull back a little bit and we're back to suppressing the virus again. So that's our fundamental message right now. We can see some early worrying signs, the kind of signs we've seen before. And a plea with the public who have done this extraordinary work over the last 10 weeks, that if we are slipping a little bit right now, to pull back, keep the disease suppressed. In the grand scheme of things, it is a matter of weeks before we can begin to do more things because of the progressive protection of vaccination.
Thank you for joining us on the programme this morning, Professor Philip Nolan from NPHET there.
Well, meanwhile, the Taoiseach is seeking a meeting with the chief executive of AstraZeneca over the continuing shortfall in vaccine supplies. The move follows increased political pressure over the pace of the vaccine rollout. The opposition has also accused the government of not providing enough clear information to those waiting for their jab. We're joined now on the line by the co-leader of the Social Democrats, Roisin Shortall. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, you say that more clarity is needed, but is there any point in setting vaccination targets at the moment if they're going to be missed?
Well, I think it's important that we do recognise the volatility in the supply of vaccines, and that's certainly a big concern. But even within the parameters of what we know we're likely to receive, I think the messaging could be better. For example, 3 weeks ago, the minister announced that we were starting to vaccinate the over 70s. Now, that's a very big group of people. It's about 500,000 people. And, you know, I think it's important that the scheduling of that be set set out very clearly, because as of now, we're only at the point of finishing the group of people over 85. So people are waiting anxiously, and that's great that there's such enthusiasm for the vaccines. But it's important that there's more clarity in relation to when people are likely to receive those. And, you know, that's a very important group. It's the cohort 3 in the priority list. But equally then, there's cohort 4, which is people who have serious underlying conditions that put them at very high risk. And there's about 160,000 people in that group. So just yesterday, the minister made it clear that it's going to be about the middle of May by the time all people over 70 will receive their vaccine. And we now need clarity in relation to that group 4, people with the serious underlying conditions. Because as of this week, there's only about 10,000 being done. So it's going to be some time before the rest of that group of 160,000 are done. So my concern is that people's expectations are being raised without providing the kind of clarity about the timescale that will be involved before they receive their vaccines.
And yet we know that one of the big problems here is supply. What, in your view, can the government do to boost supply? Because it says it's doing absolutely everything it can in that area.
Yeah, I think it is unfair to lay the blame at the government's door for the difficulties in supply, I have to say. There are issues that arise from us being part of the EU arrangement, and, you know, that is what it is. The EU were late in placing orders and so on, and there's a difficulty as a result of that. Now, you know, we need to continue to press the at EU level for greater efforts to be made to access vaccines from the suppliers. And we also need an early decision in relation to the Russian Sputnik vaccine, which by all indications, it's a very, very good vaccine. But we need to have that considered and approved at an early stage. I think, you know, we have to bear in mind that the supply is going to be less than was originally expected. But in that context, there are a couple of things. As I say, we need to be clearer about when people are likely to receive their vaccines. But the other thing is that we need to be sure that when we do start receiving those higher numbers, and we're expecting about 1 million a month over the second quarter of April, May and June, we have to be absolutely sure that the system will be ready to get those vaccines out as quickly as possible.
And do you have your doubts about that then? Because the government has said all along that, you know, in that area at least everything is going to plan.
Well, we don't know whether it is or not, really. We're being given these assurances, but it would be good to see the plan set down on paper. At the moment, the number of vaccines being administered per day is just over 12,000. Now, if we get to a point, and hopefully we will get to that point in the second quarter, and, you know, that's starting just next month, where there'll be a if we're getting the 1 million plus doses per month, there'll be a need to ramp that up to about 35,000 doses being administered every day. And we need an assurance that everything is in place for that, that the locations for the mass vaccination centres are absolutely firmed up, and that the necessary staff will be available in the places where they're needed.
Oh, right.
And for that reason, I've been calling on the Minister to actually publish a plan for the rollout of the mass vaccination programme, because we haven't seen that as of yet.
All right, Roisin Shortall, thanks for joining us this morning.
The stockbroker Davies is up for sale, but will this bring a sorry chapter for the company to an end and provide a fresh start? Let's hear more from our business editor, Will Goodbody. There's been speculation about a sale after the central bank fine and key resignations at Davies. Will, now a board decision that the company will be sold. Why?
Well, essentially, Anya, it's been seen as a key step in restoring trust in the business. I mean, Davies clearly in a very deep crisis of its own making at this point. And let's for a second just remember how much has happened over the past 10 days. I mean, just on Monday of last week, Davies was the largest stockbroker in the country, trusted with a strong reputation, valued at as much as €400 million. The following day, it was hit with that large fine from the central bank and extremely trenchant criticism about its behaviour. By Saturday, three of its most senior figures, including its CEO, had resigned. By Monday, the National Treasury Treasury Management Agency was pulling its authorization to act as a primary dealer in government bonds. Then Davy itself closed its bond desk, made four people redundant. We heard more criticism of it from the central bank on Tuesday at the Oireachtas Committee. And all the while, the public, politicians, staff and clients have been understandably asking searching questions about how all this could have happened. So in that short space of time, the firm has lost a huge amount of its credibility, trust and goodwill. And now a step on the road to restoring all of that did come with the remaining 16 members of staff who were in the consortium that was involved in this controversial transaction in 2014, leaving the company in recent days. But the difficulty is that some of those people and others involved in this controversy who had already left Davy still hold a significant portion of Davy's shares. So both in order to help settle the business for staff, customers and the public, restore trust and to make sure those at the centre of the controversy don't retain any involvement going forward, the best option the board seems to think is to sell the group, and the shareholders obviously agree.
And Bank of Ireland, of course, used to have a majority stake in Davies before the management buyout. So presumably they're interested in buying. Are there others?
Yeah, I mean, the Bank of Ireland has been linked with it in recent days. Both Bank of Ireland, though, and Davy have declined to comment. In many ways, it would seem a good fit on paper. As you say, it used to own 90% until 2006. Davy would bring fresh revenue streams from different services at a time when banks are struggling to make decent profits from traditional lending. It could also bring new clients as well. That said, there will be likely other potential suitors, both domestic and from overseas. I mean, names like Irish Life and Swiss wealth manager Julius Baer, Brewin Dolphin, and others have also been mentioned as firms that could potentially take a look. The concern for staff, of course, is that Davy could be broken up with different parts sold to different buyers. But I think whoever buys it, the process will take many months. There are still many unanswered questions. There's an independent internal inquiry about to be launched. And so extremely rigorous due diligence will have to be done before any deal is inked. It's likely any deal would involve a staggered series of payments, though, with some money held back for a time as a kind of insurance. Important to note, too, that the deal to sell would require 75% backing from the shareholders.
And reaction from the Finance Minister, Pascal Donoghue, finally, Will.
Yeah, he said last night that he's supportive of the announcement that it's up for sale. He said Davy's an important financial services firm employing around 700 people, has a diverse range of institutional, retail, charity, credit union and corporate clients. And it's important to have a stable, well-managed local stockbroking community to support Indigenous companies. So it's clear the government wants this situation to settle down quickly so that it doesn't get dragged any further into dealing with it. And that as the minister said, the stockbroking community here is strong and robust.
All right, that's our business editor, Will Goodbody.
Now let's get the business headlines next from Brian Finn.
Rachel, thank you. Bank of Ireland is regarded as the front runner for any purchase of Davy, which, as we've been hearing, is now on the market. However, there are others understood to be interested. The Currency is reporting that the Swiss bank Julius Baer is lining up to bid. The S&P 500 index in New York hit an all-time high last night as Joe Biden prepares to sign his $1.9 trillion stimulus plan into law. The prospect of the stimulus had prompted investors to dump bonds and stocks over inflation fears that had caused the interest rate on long-dated bonds in particular to rise in recent months, but they've settled down somewhat in recent days. And European bond yields had also been edging upwards, but the European Central Bank President Christine Lagarde pledged yesterday to step up the pace at which it buys bonds in order to keep the borrowing rate low for governments. The NTMA here sold 10-year debt at a rate of close to zero yesterday. Any suggestion of inflation causing rates to rise would cause concern at a time when governments are borrowing heavily to finance their COVID supports. On the currencies, the euro is trading at $1.19.5 and 85.7 pence sterling.
24 minutes to 8 now, and Des Cahill has Friday sports news.
Hi Anya, how are you? We're starting with news of golf, and an excellent start for Ireland's Shane Lowry at the lucrative Players' Championship in Sawgrass. Carries a first prize of over $2 million. Lowry's in a share of third place. Despite a bogey on the last hole, he finished with a round of 68. That's 4 under par, 3 behind the leader Sergio Garcia. Graham McDowell shot 73. He's 1 over par. Rory McIlroy, a disastrous 79. He's 7 over par. Now, a significant injury blow for Republic of Ireland manager Stephen Kenny ahead of the start of his side's World Cup qualifying campaign this month. First choice goalkeeper Darren Randolph has been ruled out through injury. A further worry for Stephen Kenny is that Liverpool's Quevin Keller is also nursing injury at present. Could leave him with a choice between the inexperienced Mark Travers on the bench at Bournemouth or Gavin Bazunu, who's playing in League One with Rochdale. Now to last night's Europa League action. Harry Kane scored twice as Tottenham had a 2-0 win at home to Dinamo Zagreb in the first leg of their tie. Two late goals gave Arsenal a crucial 3-1 victory away to Greek side Olympiakos. AC Milan scored a stoppage time equaliser to secure a 1-1 draw with Manchester United at Old Trafford after 18-year-old Amad Diallo had given United the lead. A frustrating result for the United defender Harry Maguire.
Well, yeah, we've let them back in it, obviously, with the tie at halfway and the trip to the San Siro. But no, it's only halfway. We've got to stay positive. It's disappointing, obviously, to concede in the last minute, especially a set play when we didn't play well. We didn't play at our best, but we was comfortable in the game. They didn't create. I think they had a lot of possession after we scored the first goal, but they didn't create chances. And it just looks like it's going to be seen out at 1-0. And to concede the way we did is really, really poor.
Let's talk about Amad Diallo, because he sees his chance fantastically. He's got the scoring touch, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's a young boy, big future. Obviously coming on at half-time and trying to impress and scores really early. And so that gave him confidence. And you can see day in, day out in training that he's really starting to improve and work on his intensity and his tempo of his play. And he's going to be a big player for us.
Elsewhere, the newly crowned Scottish champions Rangers battle back to earn a 1-1 draw away at Slavia Prague. Ajax beat Young Boys 3-0. Villarreal won 2-0 at Dynamo Kiev. Granada had a 2-0 victory against Malta, and Roma were 3-0 winners at home to Shakhtar Donetsk. Well, the domestic season gets back into action tonight when the country's top two sides meet in the President's Cup final. It's Shamrock Rovers versus Dundalk in Tallaght, and Rovers manager Stephen Bradley has been talking to John Kenny about their return.
Yeah, really looking forward to getting back. We know it's a great game to start with. Two good teams, Tallaght being in great condition. So yeah, we're delighted to be getting started tomorrow.
So what has the preparation been like then?
It's been good. We've had heavy pre-season like normal. You've had your double days, you've had a lot of games. We've had, I think tomorrow's our eighth pre-season game, which has been really good. But like I said, the players have worked really hard. They've come back in tremendous shape and they're ready to go. You can see that hunger and desire and they've worked really hard, so they're ready to go. We're fortunate that this club is a full-time professional club. The players have been for quite some time, so they understand that they get their 3 to 4 weeks off every year and that's it. And they've got to make sure that they live their life the right way. When they have their downtime, they obviously can switch off and enjoy that, but when we're working, it's time to work and get ready to go.
So serious action to look forward to, and the match can be seen free and live on Watch LOI tonight. In cycling, Sam Bennett's great form continued when he won Stage 5 of the Paris-Nice race, his second sprint victory this week. Slovenia's Primož Roglič continues to lead overall. In tennis, Roger Federer's comeback from injury ended in the quarterfinals of the Qatar Open. He was beaten by Nicolas Basilashvili. In rugby, the Irish coach Andy Farrell will name his side today for Sunday's Six Nations clash with Scotland in Murrayfield. Donal Lennon will be looking ahead to that game later in the programme. Meanwhile, Munster take on Scarlets tonight at Thomond Park in the Guinness Pro 14. And we've two race meetings today. Goran Park begins at 1:40 and Dundalk at 4:55.
Gardaí searching land in Drogheda in County Louth as part of the investigation into the murder of a teenager have discovered partial skeletal remains. The discovery was made yesterday during the search for the remains of a 17-year-old boy who was killed in January of last year and whose body was dismembered. Our northeast correspondent Sinead Hussey has been following developments. Sinead, are Gardaí confident that these are the remains of the missing boy?
Well, Rachel, the remains will have to undergo pathology testing to confirm, first of all, if they're human. But at this stage, Gardaí believe they are. And DNA testing will then have to be carried out to establish whether they are those of the 17-year-old boy who was murdered and his remains dismembered. But they have been searching this particular area behind the Rathmullen Park estate since Wednesday. They were acting on credible information that they received in recent weeks that the remains may have been buried or concealed at the site. It was a massive operation involving Garda divers, the Garda dog unit, the Louth divisional search team and the Garda technical bureau also on site. And as you said, sometime yesterday afternoon, officers found remains buried in the wasteland and a number of items of evidence were removed from the scene. What's significant about this is that searches have been carried out in the past in different parts of Drogheda in the Old Bridge area just before Christmas last year, and there was nothing found. But yesterday, obviously significant evidence has been found and these remains have been located.
Now, for legal reasons, we can't name the boy, but what can you tell us about this investigation?
Well, this investigation began in January of last year after the 17-year-old was murdered. Some of the remains were found in Dublin in the days after the killing. And since then, Gardaí have been searching for the rest of the remains. As I said, searches carried out in Oldbridge outside Drogheda, but nothing was found. And if these remains prove to be the remains of the teenager, it will help Gardaí progress their investigation and obviously give the teenager's family some sort of closure, and that will allow for the burial of the rest of the remains. In the investigation so far, Gardaí have questioned 8 people and 2 people have been before the courts. But obviously, yesterday's find will be significant evidence in their inquiries.
Will Gardaí be back at the site today?
Yeah, the area remained sealed off last night. The remains were at the scene, and further searches, Gardaí say, will take place. They want to ensure, and this area is quite, you know, it's quite remote, it's quite difficult to access, but they want to ensure that the area above and below ground is thoroughly searched before they leave the scene and before this operation is complete.
Sinead, many thanks for joining us with that update. That was our Northeast correspondent Sinead Hussey reporting from Drogheda.
Now, fitness trackers are increasingly popular, the watch-like devices that measure your steps, your heart rate and the distance you've travelled. Many people love trackers to motivate them to stay fit or get fitter. But now some doctors are warning that you really do need to see these things as fitness devices and not medical ones. Cian McCormack reports.
I'm just out getting some exercise, clearing my head, starting my day.
Alison Dillon is out for an early morning run.
It's the most positive way to kind of set yourself up when I'm stuck on a chair for the rest of the day, to be honest, probably till about 6.
She uses a fitness watch.
It's good, it motivates me. I'm not hung up on it, I don't wear it at night or anything, but I definitely use it to track the distances I'm doing, just to keep me motivated.
Martina Murphy and Peter Smith use similar devices.
It tracks my steps, my heart rate, my calories.
It tracks my cardiovascular fitness.
The Irish edition of the Sunday Times reported recently doctors are seeing more people turning up in hospital with concerns about their heart rates. These concerns stem from what they see on their wearable fitness trackers.
I'm not surprised. I've heard of stories, all right, where people have used their, the readings from their Fitbit on their heart rate.
Martina Murphy sees this as something positive.
And it has led them to go to the doctor. And I think that's a good thing.
Dr. Dermot McCaffrey, a consultant cardiologist at the Beacon Hospital in Dublin, has seen at least 4 people a month presenting with heart rate concerns based on data from their watches or trackers.
These trackers have been out for many years, and the people who are using them might be sort of athletes, but now you're having a relatively sedentary 70-year-old whose children have bought it for them. They're out of condition. They go for a short stroll up a small incline and their heart rate goes up to 180, and they bring that back, and then somebody goes, that's not normal. And even though, yes, they were breathless, that could be normal for them. They might present with those concerns. I'm not worried about the devices, and sometimes they do pick up arrhythmias that were not that were sort of silent and where people were unaware of, and that's useful. But obviously, the more data we get, the more it has to be interpreted with caution.
Dr. Angie Brown, a consultant cardiologist in the Bonds Hospital in Dublin and medical director of the Irish Heart Foundation, says fitness devices are not medical ones.
Well, they're very popular, and they definitely have benefits, as they're very good at incentivizing people and encouraging physical activity, which is really important. But most of these aren't medical devices, and therefore they shouldn't be used as such. I am seeing a similar trend, not certainly as much as Dr. McCaffrey, but we do have email queries, and when patients come to the clinic, they give me their smartwatch data, and they often have concerns about their heart rate. So we need to then investigate if this is a true finding or a false finding.
Professor Niall Moyna, an exercise physiologist at the School of Health and Human Performance at DCU, says we need to understand fitness wearables because they are part of our future.
Wearable technology is ubiquitous. Within a decade, we won't have to put on a watch anymore. We will be automatically monitored just by the shirt that we're actually wearing. One of the things that would concern me is probably the lack of health literacy in the population in general, is that we're going to be getting lots of information, and we could end up with a lot of people who are very, very worried, because they may go out and see that their heart rate goes to maybe to 200 beats a minute when they're exercising. But that's a normal response. But to understand that that's a normal response.
And that was exercise physiologist and DCU professor Niall Moyna, ending that report from Cian McCormack. 10 to 8, let's get the business news now from Brian Finn.
Áine, thank you. We're joined this morning by Fergal O'Rourke, who's managing partner with PwC, to hear about the mood of CEOs here and overseas against the backdrop of the pandemic. But before we take a look at that, Fergal, the big news in business this morning again is Davy. The board has put the company up for sale. Is the brand salvageable, do you think, or is this the end of the road for the Davy name?
No, I think the brand is salvageable. I think it's a long-established Irish company, and I think it'll play out as it will over the next couple of weeks and months.
Presumably there'd be a fair bit of interest in acquiring the business, or certainly parts of it.
Yes, I suspect there would be an awful lot of interest over the coming weeks.
As I said, you've been talking to CEOs, and one of the issues they raised was over-regulation. And while it's understandable that companies want to reduce the amount of red tape that they're subject to, if the last week has taught us anything, it's that regulation is as necessary as ever.
Yeah, I think if anybody has asked the question whether they think their particular industry, no matter what it is over-regulated, the answer is usually likely to be yes. I think once regulation is appropriate and proportionate, it's fine, and nearly all businesses accept that. I think it's relevant that you would review those regulations every so often to make sure they still are appropriate and proportionate. But I suppose that's a question which, you know, if you ask a child, do they like school, do they like to go to school, maybe the answer these days would be yes, but normally it would be no.
Can I ask you what you thought about what you heard over the last few weeks? This issue with Davy was something that happened nearly 7 years ago now, at a time when corporate Ireland was really trying to salvage its own reputation.
Sorry, in the sense of...
It was in the aftermath of the crash, so Ireland as a country and businesses in Ireland were really trying to get back on their feet.
Yes, that's right.
In relation to what happened in Davy, just what did you think when you heard about it?
Well, I suppose, as you say, it does come from a period of 7 or 8 years ago. And the regulator has gone in, the regulator has determined an issue, and it'll move on. I think it's a good sign that regulation in Ireland works.
CEOs here, they're more upbeat than last year, but not as upbeat about the outlook as their global counterparts, which I thought was surprising in the context of Ireland being the only country to post growth last year.
Yeah, but I think, I suppose, if you look at last year when this survey was done, it was actually done before COVID emerged as a threat. And we tend to forget that if you look back, people were quite negative about the economy this time last year. There were a lot of storm clouds on the horizon. So I think given what Irish businesses have been through, I'm probably not surprised they're a little bit behind the optimism of other countries. When I talk to my counterparts around the world, many of them are in economies that have opened up significantly quicker than Ireland, or they haven't suffered as deep a lockdown as Ireland. Or, for example, if you take the US, the vaccine rollout is going quicker. So I think the combination here of probably one of the most severe lockdowns in the world has probably, and therefore for many businesses, an inability to trade has probably contributed to the Irish CEO being marginally less positive about the future. But having said that, a 49% positivity rate about the Irish economy among Irish CEOs, that was 16% last year. Now it's far off the 92% in 2015. But if you actually ask them about their own businesses, they're very confident their own business. So only 49% of CEOs believe the economy will do very well next year. 82% of them feel their own business will do well. I think that's a really good sign for those industries.
Just a word on Brexit, Fergal, another postponement of checks, which is good for exporters, probably not great for the overall process, in that it's been pushed out further again.
Yeah, and I mean, if you're an exporter, it is difficult. You've been living with uncertainty for the last 3 or 4 years as to what the last outcome would be, and that's going to continue. I think if we look back to when we joined the EU, how dominant a trading partner the UK was, and how since our accession to the EU, we've weaned ourselves off global proximity and to a large trading bloc will always mean we'll trade with the UK. But I think as we evolve over the next decade, you're going to see a slow but perceptible shift of trading away. It'll still always be a major partner, but I think our trade with Europe and the recent expansion of the Rosslare-Dunkirk route, for example, is just another sign that businesses are looking more to Europe to see can they expand their markets.
Fergal O'Rourke, Managing Partner with PwC, thank you. More business news at 8:30.
Time we got the weekend weather forecast. Joining us from Met Erin this morning is Paul Downs. Morning, Paul.
Good morning. Well, there's a mix of sunny spells and blustery showers this morning, bringing the risk of hail, sleet and isolated thunderstorms. This afternoon, cloud will increase, with bands of more persistent showery rain extending from the west this evening. Highs of 6 to 9 degrees, but feeling cooler in fresh to strong and very gusty southwesterly winds, reaching near gale force in the southwest early tonight. The more organised bands of blustery showers will clear eastwards early tonight, leaving some clear spells with scattered thundery showers. It'll be a cold night with lows of 0 to plus 3 degrees in fresh to strong and gusty southwest to westerly winds. Sunny spells and blustery showers once again on Saturday, heaviest and most frequent in the west and northwest. Highs of just 5 to 9 degrees, feeling colder however in a biting fresh to strong and gusty west to northwest wind. Mostly cloudy with patchy rain drizzle on Sunday, milder however with highs of 8 to 12 degrees in moderate to fresh westerly winds. Winds will ease as high pressure continues to build over the country through the early days of next week. Relatively calm, dry and pleasant conditions will prevail, with highs in the mid-teens up to and including St Patrick's Day. That's all from me and the team at Met Erin. Have a lovely day.
The Advisory Group for Vaccinations has made a new recommendation to the Department of Health that the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine can be used for people aged 70 years and older. Last month, the Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Houlihan, advised the government that the vaccine should not be administered to those in this age group. However, the National Immunisation Advisory Committee issued its latest recommendation on foot of new evidence about AstraZeneca's effectiveness. Here's our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers.
The National Immunisation Advisory Committee advises the Chief Medical Officer on vaccinations. In early February, it said that the AstraZeneca vaccine could be used for those aged 65 and older, but where possible and timely, an mRNA vaccine like Pfizer or Moderna should be used instead. The Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Houlihan, advised the government that the vaccine should not be used for those aged 70 and older. Now in a fresh review, the National Immunisation Advisory Committee has recommended that the AstraZeneca vaccine can be used for those aged 70 years and older. It is also said there should be no delay in vaccination. So far, over 100,000 people over 70 have been given a first dose, mainly using the Pfizer vaccine. But there are still around 400,000 people in Cohort 3, those aged 70 and older, to be vaccinated. The Deputy Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Ronan Glynn, is expected to give a revised view to government shortly, having now received the new recommendation on AstraZeneca.
The Minister for Finance, Pascal Donoghue, has said he supports the announcement by the board of the country's largest stockbroker, Davy, to put the group up for sale. Last night, Mr. Donoghue said it was important that Ireland had a stable and well-managed local stockbroking community to support Indigenous companies. Last week, the central bank fined Davy more than €4 million for breaching market rules over a transaction involving its own staff. Our business editor, Will Goodbody.
In a brief two-line statement, Davy's board said it had decided to pursue a sale of the group and that Rothschild & Co. had been appointed as financial advisor to manage the process. It follows a record €4.1 million fine from the central bank for market rule breaches in relation to a transaction in 2014 where a client sold a bond but wasn't told it was a consortium of 16 Davy staff who bought it. Last weekend, three senior figures, including the chief executive, resigned, while on Monday the company shut down its bond desk, making four staff redundant after the National Treasury Management Agency pulled Davy's authority to act as a primary dealer in government bonds. But a number of those who left Davy in the past week still remain significant shareholders in the company, and so the changing of the shareholding structure is therefore being seen as a key step to restoring trust in the business. There's likely to be significant interest in the firm, with Bank of Ireland already reported to have made exploratory contact with Davy, something the bank has declined to comment on.
The US President Joe Biden has said he will order all US states to make every adult in the country eligible for a COVID-19 vaccine by the 1st of May. Mr. Biden made the announcement in his first primetime address last night. Our Washington correspondent Brian O'Donovan.
It was this time last year that the first COVID-19 restrictions were announced here in the US, and to coincide with that anniversary, President Joe Biden delivered his first primetime address to the nation last night. He said it had been a year of collective suffering, sacrifice and loss, noting that more than 520,000 Americans have died from the virus. The president announced that he was ordering all states to make every adult eligible for a COVID-19 vaccine by the 1st of May. He said that his target for vaccine rollout was running ahead of schedule and expressed hope that by the 4th of July, America might not just be celebrating Independence Day, but also independence from the virus. Brian O'Donovan, RTE News, Washington.
Gardaí have issued a fresh appeal to a driver following the death of a 45-year-old man in a road incident in Mayo on Wednesday night. The vehicle did not stop at the scene. Gardaí have renewed their appeal to the driver to come forward. Our Western correspondent, Pat McGrath.
It's understood the deceased man was originally from Eastern Europe but had been living here for some time. He sustained fatal injuries when he was hit by a vehicle on Humbert Way on the outskirts of Castlebar at around 11:50 on Wednesday night. A post-mortem examination was carried out on the man's body at Mayo University Hospital last evening. Following a forensic examination of the crash site, detectives have been reviewing CCTV and dash cam footage in an effort to identify the vehicle involved in the hit and run. They've urged the motorist who left the scene to come forward and to contact any Garda station. Pat McGrath, RTE News, Galway.
And now the weather.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Super Value. Get thousands of really low prices in the Super Value range, available in-store and online. Believe in low prices.
Sunny spells and heavy blustery showers this morning with a likelihood of hail or sleet and isolated thunderstorms. Cloud will increase this afternoon with bands of more persistent showery rain extending from the west this evening. Highest temperatures will range from 6 to 9 degrees. And there's a warning that southwest winds veering west will increase to gale force 8 or strong gale force 9 at times this afternoon, evening and overnight on coastal waters from Strangford Lough to Mizenhead to Errishead and on the Irish Sea.
RTE Radio 1 Traffic and Travel with the all-new Hyundai Tucson. Ireland's best-selling car this year.
The latest travel news from the AA. Gardaí in Dublin are dealing with a crash on the Swords Road inbound after the Collins Avenue junction, and traffic is slow between there and Griffith Avenue. Elsewhere, there are westbound delays on the Clare Hall Road approaching the M1-M50 interchange. Moving to Sligo on the N15, traffic is beginning to slow at those works north of Drumcliff between Castlegarn and Grange. South of that in Galway, traffic is slowing towards the city on the Tuam Road approaching its junction with Bohorna Drive. Finally, for those in Youghal in Cork, delays are building on North Main Street approaching the Church Street junction. Anna Cullen, AA Road Watch.
That's here again what it says in Friday's papers from Fiona Kelly.
Hopes and fears surrounding the lifting of COVID restrictions, for sale, Davy stockbrokers, and the first minister in the history of the state to take maternity leave are some of the stories covered on your front pages this morning. The Irish Independent leads with the line that the return of non-contact training for children and golf and tennis for all ages could be on the cards if transmission of the virus falls significantly before the 5th of April. For its lead story, meanwhile, the Irish Examiner reports on how residents of nursing homes are to be allowed to receive up to two visits per week from the 22nd of March. In common with the story in the front of the Irish Times. However, that paper also reports that although the 5 kilometre limit and restrictions on construction are expected to be relaxed on April the 5th, the easing of other restrictions appears unlikely following NPHET's warning that the situation remains precarious after 592 cases of the virus and 10 deaths were announced yesterday. The Taoiseach's move to seek a meeting with the chief executive of AstraZeneca amid concerns about the number of vaccines the company is likely to deliver by the end of the month generates a lead story in the Irish Daily Mail. For its lead story, the Irish Times reports on the statement issued by Davy Stockbrokers last night, saying that the company has hired the international investment bank Rothschild to find a buyer. Frustration surrounding the failure of ministers in the north to provide clarity about when all primary school pupils will be back in the classroom provides the lead story in the Irish News, while the Belfast Telegraph leads with warnings from Stormont executives that a full return to school could be delayed if people flout COVID rules on Mother's Day or St Patrick's Day. The Irish Daily Star leads with yesterday's discovery of skeletal remains by Gardaí in Drogheda, County Louth, as part of the investigation into the murder of a 17-year-old boy who was killed in January of last year. For its lead story, the Irish Sun reports on comments made by Aontú leader Padraig Tobin in the Dáil yesterday, calling for an investigation into allegations that junior prison officers at Portlaoise Prison made threats against a senior officer in October 2018. Although a number of prison officers and prisoners, including convicted murderer Freddie Thompson, were interviewed, no action was ever taken. The Irish Daily Mirror leads with a report on a funeral which was attended by 300 mourners in Carrick-on-Shannon in County Leitrim yesterday. Back on the front of today's Times, Suzanne Lynch reports that the US Senate is preparing to unveil a resolution outlining support for the Belfast Agreement ahead of next week's online meeting between the Taoiseach and US President Joe Biden. Minister for Justice Helen McEntee is pictured on the front of The Independent. Although Heather Humphreys is due to step into her role to allow her to take 6 months paid maternity leave from the end of April, Minister McEntee is quoted saying that she believes that the lack of maternity leave for politicians needs a long-term solution. A number of today's papers report that Bartra Capital has been refused planning permission for a 5-storey nursing home in Dalkey, County Dublin, which had been opposed by broadcaster Pat Kenny. There's a story in today's Examiner about a call on beachcombers to report any sightings of the blue crab, which was found on Dollymount Strand in Dublin last month, since we're told it's actually an invasive species. And finally, as fallout from the Prince Harry and Meghan Markle interview this week continues to receive lots of coverage, a piece in today's Independent tells us that the Queen is being distracted by the arrival of 2 new corgi puppies last week. Although nobody knows the names of the puppies and no pictures have yet been released, a royal insider is quoted saying that they have been bringing a lot of noise and energy to an otherwise sombre Windsor Castle.
So amid increasing pressure on the government to secure more COVID vaccines, the Taoiseach has said he's seeking a meeting with the chief executive of AstraZeneca. The government and the HSE say the company is repeatedly failing to deliver on its commitments and that this is the main reason why vaccination targets are not being met. But GPs around the country have also reported problems with the availability of the vaccines currently being given to the over 70s. Last night, our reporter Joan O'Sullivan spoke to 2 GPs, Dr. David McNeil in County Mayo and Dr. Anne Spellman in County Sligo, about how they feel the vaccine rollout is going.
Once we get the vaccines in the surgeries, the rollout is very smooth. Now, I suppose the only issue we're having is the supply of vaccines. At the minute, we're quite unsure of what supply we're going to get next week in 2 of our surgeries, but we still haven't got a confirmation of the numbers. Now, from speaking with the people in the HSE, they're probably saying our numbers are going to be reduced, but they can't tell us at this stage by how much they're going to be reduced. And I guess from speaking to other colleagues as well across the county, they seem to be having the same issues.
What kind of problems does this cause for you when you can't be exact about how much vaccines you're going to have delivered?
On the day, we will have a clinic booked in, you know, probably about 100, 120 people. We have to give those people a bit of notice because a lot of those people are elderly. They may not be able to get to the clinic themselves, so they will need to have people to drive them there or indeed people to just to accompany them. If we don't find out until the morning of the clinic that we're going to have 100 vaccines or 120 or 80 vaccines on that day, if we have X amount booked in, then we have to disappoint people by actually ringing them back to cancel the vaccines for that day and push them out until the next delivery. We've had that this week already, where we had a shortage just of, luckily enough, it was just two vaccines at the end of the day.
The cohort of patients who we're vaccinating are our elderly patients, so it's quite difficult to organise to get all of those patients in and to do so in a very safe way. It is difficult. We're in a bigger town practice, but for more rural practices where the patient numbers are smaller, some of those practices we heard slipped through the cracks. So they were later getting their delivery. And that's really difficult when you have patients lined up, you know, to be told you'll be getting your vaccination at a certain week and then to not even have the vaccines arrive. It is incredibly difficult. And you have to remember as well, we're still working as GPs. So we have, you know, other things to do, and we've blocked out time for these vaccination clinics. And then if they can't go ahead for a certain reason, it's more time blocked out where we're away from doing our other GP tasks.
Dr. Anne Spellman and Dr. David McNeil, they were speaking last night to Joan O'Sullivan. The Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly, joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Rachel.
We can come to the AstraZeneca situation in a moment, but can I ask you first of all about what we heard from the doctors there? They're not relying on AstraZeneca because they're vaccinating the over 70s. So why are they having problems?
That's right. So in the first 3 weeks, there's no question but that whilst the vast majority of the programme went well, there were some issues. And I think as those two GPs have voiced very fairly, it causes an awful lot of anxiety for our patients. So the HSC has looked very carefully at the parts of the programme that needed improvement, and they are making quite significant changes. So for example, they've added in a new call centre for GPs. They're working closely with the distribution company to see what improvements can be made, because they would accept themselves that there are some improvements. I do think, though, it is worth reminding your listeners, Rachel, that whilst there has very understandably been a focus on the parts of that 3 week program that didn't work, ultimately, the target in that 3 weeks was to vaccinate those 85 and older. And the HSE is reporting that in excess of 99% of that target was met. So while we must always strive to do more, I think it is worth just mentioning that 99% of the target cohort were in fact vaccinated in that 3 week period.
Okay, we know the big problem is with the AstraZeneca vaccine, and the Taoiseach is seeking a meeting now with the chief executive of the company. What does he hope to achieve?
Well, what's going on with AstraZeneca is very, very frustrating, not just for Ireland, but globally. I was talking to AstraZeneca last night and putting some of these questions, and essentially what they are saying is that they have been having unanticipated problems with their global supply chains. So these are very complex compounds and vaccines that are manufactured. And as was explained to me, they've been putting in place very significant manufacturing capacity at a speed that they would never normally do it. And they've admitted that they have had problems. What I emphasized last night was two issues. The first was that we are very, very frustrated with the fact that the volumes that we have agreed and contracted for are not being met. And secondly, that the volumes are constantly being revised down, and it's causing a lot of problems in terms of the logistics, and it's causing a lot of anxiety amongst the public, because the flip side of this is there is a huge demand for these vaccines, and for very good reason. In fact, I was just looking at the latest figures I got this morning before talking to you, Rachel, and believe it or not, last week, so in a 1 week period between week 8 and week 9, for the target groups we vaccinated so far, so that's the nursing homes, the healthcare workers, and the over 85s, there's been nearly a 50% reduction in COVID cases in 1 week. Now, whilst that is astonishingly good news, it increases the need we have to get a reliable supply from AstraZeneca.
Okay.
We're broadly getting it from Pfizer, we're broadly getting it from Moderna, and we need to get it from AstraZeneca as well.
Okay, so just going back then to that conversation you had last night, because this is the first time that we've heard about this, at what level was the person you were talking to, and did they make you any commitments?
So the person I was talking to is they've appointed a new country rep for Ireland, essentially. And the commitment that they are making is that they are doing everything they can. They accept that what is going on is far from ideal. They accept that it is causing a lot of frustration, but much more importantly than frustration in government or the HSC, it's causing real anxiety for people on the ground, and that's just not fair. And what they have committed to is doing everything they can to fix that. And importantly, they did recommit to the total volumes being delivered, because as you know, we have pre-purchased.
Did they give you any dates for those, though? Did they give you any dates
for those?
No, they
can't yet. No. That's an ongoing conversation. And one of the things I said was, look, if you're going to give us dates and you're going to give us volumes, they need to be the right volumes, because this repeated revising down of the volumes is just causing an awful lot of anxiety for people, and it's not fair and it's not right.
You see, but what puzzles people here is that throughout this, the United Kingdom has experienced no difficulties with supply from AstraZeneca. Indeed, we heard yesterday on the programme that in the north this week, they were getting more vaccines than they'd expected to get, and that they would be able to accelerate the rollout there still further. So what's going on here?
Well, it's a very serious issue, and it's one that the Commissioner von der Leyen has taken up directly with the company. There is a very serious high-level conversation going on between the Commission steering group, which we participate on, and the company. There were suggestions being made some weeks ago that, you know, maybe while the UK was getting everything it had ordered, the EU wasn't, and people were looking at where things were being manufactured. That is an ongoing conversation. To date, we haven't had any evidence that there is essentially any funny business going on. But, you know, ultimately what we've got to do directly with the company and through the Commission is to make sure that we get the supply that we have agreed to, and critically that we get it on time, because time really does matter. As I know Professor Nolan was saying earlier on your programme, the plan is working. The level 5 measures are working because people are sticking with them, but people are tired and time matters.
Okay.
And the quicker we can get people vaccinated, the quicker we can have a conversation about opening up the country.
Okay, and we can come back to that in a moment, but just in relation to the overall supply situation, I'm looking at a report in the New York Times this morning saying that America has 30 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine, even though it's not authorised for use there. In fact, the company hasn't even applied for the authorisation yet. Have we asked for any of that?
Well, so those conversations will be being had by the European Commission steering group. So there's no member state says, well, you know, we have. So, for example, we have pre-purchased over 3 million doses. We've pre-purchased 3.3 million doses of AstraZeneca. It's not for any of the member states to say, well, you know, you've got a supply in America. Can we have some of that? That's a conversation that the European Commission is having on an ongoing basis with the company. And when it comes in, it gets distributed on a pro rata basis. So, for example,
AstraZeneca nor the European Commission seems to be getting anywhere with America on this. The answer has been no. So I'm just wondering if maybe it is time for a personal intervention for Micheál Martin to raise it perhaps with Joe Biden when he speaks to him next week.
I'm sure he could, but remember, if that is, you know, America's pre-purchase, then it really that is a conversation I guess between America and the company and America and the Commission. But I have no doubt that if the Taoiseach believes that it would be of use to raise that with the President, he most certainly would.
When is it hoped that everybody in what's known as cohort 4, those with high medical risk, will be vaccinated? Because looking at the figures published this week, they show that 93 people in that group were vaccinated on Monday. Now, the target for the week was supposed to be 10,000. It's highly unlikely that target's going to be met, isn't it?
Well, let's wait to the end of the week to see. So this is a new cohort. So NIAC came back to us just in the last 2 weeks, and they had done a very thorough review And they had identified a group of people with underlying conditions that put them at very high risk. Their estimate is that it's about 160,000 people. And the plan is to vaccinate the first 10,000 of them this week. And let's wait till the end of Sunday to see what the what those figures actually are.
On Monday, you'd have to be moving at an almighty rate, wouldn't you, to get to 10,000 by the end of the week?
Well, look, let's see. It is a complex group. You see, it's not like going into the nursing homes or the healthcare settings or even indeed the over 85s. They're very easily identifiable groups. This group of 160,000 people is a very diverse group of people with a lot of different underlying conditions and being managed some by GPs, some by clinical programs in hospitals. So there's a lot of work that is going on to identify these groups, engage with these groups and then bring them in to be vaccinated. But in terms of what's done this week, let's just wait till the end of the week to see what we get back from the HSE.
Given the change in advice, we heard about it on the news bulletin earlier, is it likely that if stocks are available, because that's a big if, that the over 70s will now be given the AstraZeneca vaccine?
Well, so first of all, that advice from NIAC to the acting chief medical officer came in yesterday. He is considering that right now. He hasn't written to me formally with a recommendation. He and I will be meeting later on today to discuss it. But if it is the case that it is agreed that the NIAC recommendation is implemented, then yes, what it would do is it would make more vaccine available for the over 70s, and it would help us accelerate, particularly on the first dose. So the mRNA vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna, there's about a 4-week duration between your first and your second dose. With AstraZeneca, it's longer, which means that while it takes longer then to give everyone the second dose, you actually get the first dose vaccination for more people quicker. And there are people who would say that is quite advantageous, given that there is a very high level of protection that seems to be afforded from just one dose, in fact, yeah, for all of the vaccines.
As you say, the figures seem to support that. Given the length of this lockdown, is there a real danger that you're going to start to lose people? I'm thinking in particular, say, of pictures in the newspapers this morning of a very, very large funeral in County Leitrim.
Yes. The short answer is yes. There is a real concern. It's a concern I have, that NPHET has, that government has, that people have been through so much. It has been such a difficult year, and it's been such a difficult few months, that naturally people are tired and people are looking at the good news. People are beginning to say, well, we've got a low rate now by European standards because of the sacrifices everyone has made. The vaccine program, notwithstanding AstraZeneca, the vaccine program is going well. The protection afforded is very, very positive. So it's probably okay for me to let the guard down. And the unambiguous view we have from NPHET, Professor Nolan on your program, Dr. Glynn yesterday, was we cannot let the guard down. We're dealing almost entirely now with this B117 variant. There was a case given by NPHET last week, I think, just one example, where a single case led to 480 people being infected. We're dealing with a highly contagious virus. The plan is working. I know it is hard for people, but the numbers are still coming down. What we are seeing is mobility numbers are going up, close contacts are going up. Professor Nolan's latest calculation of the R number is now somewhere between 0.6 and 1. So while the disease trajectory is still moving in the right direction, the mobility data does give cause for concern. Okay. And really, my message and the message from our public health doctors is this has been hard. There's no question about it, but the plan is working and we need to stick with it to give more time to get the disease a bit lower and to vaccinate the most vulnerable people.
Okay, just one final question. We've heard an awful lot about the hotel quarantine regime. It's been promised for many, many weeks. It still hasn't been introduced. Why?
Well, let's be clear. It was only signed into law 5 days ago. So it was agreed by cabinet not that long ago. And it is a complex thing. Remember, we're talking about depriving people of their civil liberties, people who've done nothing wrong. So that's not a small thing to do. So it has to be done in the right way.
Now, so when will it happen then, do you think?
Very shortly. So a lot of progress has been made. There is now a single hotel operator that is being engaged with in detail. The contracts will be signed very soon, and then the system will be up and running very shortly thereafter. Right. There's a lot of work going on right across government on this.
Stephen Donnelly, Minister for Health, thank you for joining us this morning. We'll take a break.
A number of banks and investment companies have been mentioned in connection with a possible acquisition of Davy after the board announced last night that it was putting the company up for sale. Bank of Ireland is considered a front runner after it was reported to have approached the stockbroker about an acquisition this week. However, the Swiss bank Julius Baer is also mentioned as a potential suitor, as have Cantor Fitzgerald and Brewin Dolphin. A sales process is expected to take months and could involve a carve-up of the business. ESB Group has reported an operating profit before exceptional items of €616 million for 2020. That was a fall of €66 million on 2019 after what it called a challenging operating environment brought about by the COVID pandemic. Electricity demand remained resilient, it said, with increased residential demand offsetting falls in the business sector. On the currencies this morning, the euro is trading at $1.19.5 and 85.7 pence sterling.
And with the sport now, here's Des Cahill.
Yeah, good morning, Rachel. Ireland's Shane Lowry is in third place after the opening round of the lucrative Players' Championship at Sawgrass. Despite a bogey in the last hole, Lowry finished with a round of 68. That's four under par and three behind the leader, Sergio Garcia. Graham McDowell shot 73. He's one over par. Rory McIlroy, the defending champion, though, had a disastrous 79 for seven over par. In soccer news, a significant injury blow for Republic of Ireland manager Stephen Kenny ahead of the start of his side's World Cup qualifying campaign this month. First choice goalkeeper Darren Radloff has been ruled out through injury. A further worry for Kenny is that Liverpool's Quevin Kelleher is also nursing an injury at present and failed to make their Champions League squad this week owing to a stomach complaint. That would leave a choice between the inexperienced Mark Travers on the bench at Bournemouth or Gavin Bazunu, who's playing in League One with Rochdale. Now to last night's Europa League action. Harry Kane scored twice. Tottenham had a 2-0 win at home to Dinamo Zagreb in the first leg of their tie, and two late goals gave Arsenal a 3-1 victory away to Greek side Olympiakos. Newly crowned Scottish champions Rangers battled back to earn a 1-1 draw away at Slavia Prague, and AC Milan scored a stoppage time equaliser to secure a 1-1 draw with Manchester United at Old Trafford after 18-year-old Amad Diallo had given United the lead. A frustrating result for the United manager, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
Very disappointed to concede with one of the last kicks of the ball or the header there. And that makes it harder, of course. But it was always going to be going down to the second game down there anyway.
Yeah, the keeper a bit disappointed with that.
Well, it's a header from 6 yards. You can't save it, of course. I've seen him save them, but it's a structure that we lose. We drop too deep, and we get blocked off. And Shar makes a good run and gets the header on it. We should have attacked the ball with the men we've had there. Of course, we could have scored one or two more, but then again, they had loads of attempts. And especially the header second half from back stick there that just went wide. We could have gone in, so probably a draw is a fair result.
Is Ty still in the balance, obviously?
Yeah, of course, but yeah, we'll get players back, hopefully. They get players back, so it'll be a good game again with two good teams.
It should be elsewhere. Ajax beat Young Boys 3-0. Villarreal won 2-0 at Dynamo Kiev. Granada beat Molde 2-0. And Roma were 3-0 winners at home to Shakhtar Donetsk. Well, the domestic season kicks back into action tonight when the country's top two sides meet in the President's Cup final. It's Shamrock Rovers versus Dundalk in Tala. Kickoff is at 7:45. It should be a cracking start to the season, and you can watch it free on the Watch LOI platform. In cycling, Sam Bennett's great form continued when he won stage 5 of the Paris-Nice race, his second sprint victory this week. Slovenia's Primož Roglič continues to lead overall. In tennis, Roger Federer's comeback from injury ended in the quarterfinals of the Qatar Open after he was beaten by Nicolas Basilashvili. And in rugby, Munster take on Scarlets tonight at Thomond Park in the Guinness Pro 14. And there'll be huge interest, of course, when Ireland coach Andy Farrell names his side today for Sunday's Six Nations clash with Scotland in Murrayfield. Well, let's look ahead to that game now with former Irish captain Donal Lennon. Good morning, Donal.
Morning, Des.
What changes do you expect in the Irish team?
Well, I'm hoping they'll be at a minimum. Obviously, with Scotland and the physical nature of what they've been doing up front, suggestion, I think, set piece is going to be hugely important. So that means Rob Herring may well come back into the hooking position over Ronan Kelleher, who was outstanding in Italy, but may have to be satisfied with a place on the bench. I think Dave Kilcoyne, he had a head injury in the Italian game, so missed a bit of training earlier on. So Cian Healy, I think, may come back into the front row. But other than that, I think the focus will be on scrum half. Conor Murray is available. But it looks as if Gibson Park, that Andy Farrell is going to stick with him with Conor Murray on the bench. So minimal changes. And I suppose really it's a question of, do Ireland pick up from where they left off against Italy and play that high tempo game? Or do they revert to a more sort of physical set piece orientated territorial game? So that'll be interesting to see.
And what do you expect, given you mentioned the physicality of Scotland?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, we've had the measure of Scotland over the past number of years. We've won the last five in a row. I think we've won 9 out of 10. And the vast majority of them have been based on sort of dominating the set piece, playing the territorial game. And Scotland have improved in that area. I mean, this is a very good Scottish team. Paul O'Connell reckons the best that he's come across. But there are doubts about them. I mean, if it's the Scottish side who dismantled England in Twickenham, then it's going to be a difficult day for Ireland. But there's that mental brittleness about them. They were well in control against Wales up to the point where Xander Fagerson got sent off, and then they just collapsed. So I think Ireland will probably go for that territorial game early on, look to dominate Scotland, and then maybe pick up the tempo from there.
OK, we'll bring you that game live on Sunday Sport. But tomorrow, it's almost a given that Wales will win against Italy. What about the England-France game at Twickenham?
Yeah, listen, that's going to be an absolute belter of a game. England under huge pressure. They've had a poor championship. France, of course, as always, the minute they kind of get momentum, they shoot themselves in the foot. There's a lot of talk in the French camp about Fabien Galthié, their coach, a master in terms of discipline. And but he was the guy, really, all the focus in terms of the COVID and the that he was the one that broke the bubble. So it looks as if France have found a reason to, as I say, shoot themselves in the foot. But you look at the selection they have. Virime Vakatawa, probably one of the best centres in the world. He's back in midfield. Teddy Thomas is on the wing. The French backline that's playing in Twickenham Days is absolutely electric. And, you know, so I think that's going to be a cracking game. England, again, they've had, I don't think France have won at Twickenham since 2005. So, you know, it has to happen sometime. This game will be worth watching. And I think France could just about shade that one, which would be incredible.
Well, okay. Well, Donal, thanks very much for joining us. Finally, racing news, and ahead of all the madness of Cheltenham next week, we have two race meetings today. Goran Park begins at 1:40 and Dundalk at 4:55.
Social Protection Minister Heather Humphreys will temporarily replace Helen McEntee at the end of April when the Justice Minister takes 6 months maternity leave. It'll be the first time a serving Irish minister has taken maternity leave, but Ms McEntee herself said the lack of provision for maternity, paternity and other types of leave for those in public life needs a long-term solution. Our reporter Fiacra O'Kioni has been getting the reaction of a number of women politicians.
Back in 2016, when I was newly elected myself, I also had the life-changing experience, if you like, giving birth to my daughter, Juliet. So it was a pretty overwhelming time in terms of the experience of being a first-time TD and a first-time mum. And with that came the surprise and shock, perhaps, that in Dáil-Éireann, it was expected to provide a sick cert in terms of my maternity leave. And for that reason, I returned to work 2 weeks after I gave birth to Juliet.
Niamh Smith is a Fianna Fáil TD for Cavan Monaghan. Like many women before her, she says the current political system has made it difficult to have a baby while holding office. Deputy Smith says the new Minister for Justice, Helen McEntee, will be able to take 6 months paid maternity leave will help to change the situation.
Minister McEntee has now set a precedent. She's now acknowledged that it's not acceptable when, you know, a female politician has a baby that she bounces back to work the next week. However, this is a starting point and only a starting point.
Where that starting point leads to is a question another female politician, Sinn Féin TD for Carlow Kilkenny, Kathleen Function, wants to see answered.
It's actually incredible that we're in 2021 and we have actually no provisions for women to take maternity leave. So I think that this is very welcome.
Deputy Function also had decisions to make as a TD and mother, and believes Minister for Justice Helen McEntee's circumstances should start a wider debate on why this is the case.
I had two elections where I was pregnant and I would have definitely considered calling it a day just to do with the juggle of family life and the job. It does need to be something that needs to be looked at broader and to ensure then that the system works, that they do get a proper maternity leave and it's not just like a maternity leave on paper.
Whatever discussion emerges from the current debate will be watched closely by younger women in politics, including Green Party Cathaoirleach for Dunleary Rathdown County Council, Una Power.
I think it's a really welcome step in the short term, but I think in the long term, a lot more still needs to be done. And this isn't a sustainable step. It's very much an ad hoc approach. And whilst that's very welcome for the minister, we need to look at approaches that will allow for ministers, TDs, councillors to have ways to plan and organise their lives when they're expecting babies. You know, we commit as councillors to 5-year terms, as TDs, it's an up to 5-year term. It's a lot of time and it is a big impact in those kind of years of 20s, 30s. We really need to be looking at constitutional reviews on how to bring about a sustainable and long-term solution.
And that was Councillor Una Power ending Fiacra O'Kioni's report, and we can expect to hear more on all of those issues when the Citizens Assembly considers it. Pavé Point is calling on travellers to adhere fully to public health measures, including restrictions on funerals. And this follows a large funeral that took place in Carrick-on-Shannon in County Leitrim yesterday. Martin Collins from Pavé Point is on the line. Martin Collins, good morning to you.
Good morning, Anya.
I'm sure you've seen the Irish Mirror at this stage, the pictures of about 300 people, we're told, at a funeral. Huge crowds, a marquee. Paul Reid, it's his hometown, he's quoted as saying it's pretty demoralising. What's your reaction?
Well, first of all, Anya, let me convey my deepest condolences to the bereaved family and friends of the deceased. Yes, I did see the images of the marquee and the large gathering, and it is very disappointing. It's very concerning, and it's not acceptable, you know, in the middle of a global health pandemic, that some people are behaving in this way. And where Pavé Point's message has been very consistent and very clear that all people, travellers or settled, need to adhere to the public health guidelines. Public health and the preservation of life trumps everything else. I understand how difficult it is for travellers to stay away from funerals, but cultural norms and traditions will have to take a back seat at this time. People must realise at this stage, almost 4,500 people have died from COVID-19 in Ireland, and more will die if people don't observe the public health guidelines. Anya, I have a 42-year-old cousin, the father of 5 children, ranging from 7 years old up to 17 years old, getting buried this morning in Mullingar. Not only was he my cousin, he was a very good friend. I can't attend that funeral. We have to make these sacrifices. Professor Philip Nolan was on your programme earlier on, and he said it's really important that we don't relax or become complacent at this time. If we do, we will undo all the progress we have made so far.
And, you know, you talk about the sacrifices, you know, that you and so many others are making, not going to your cousin's funeral. We've seen, of course, you know, student street parties. It's not unique to members of the travelling community. But do you fear that this will lead to stigmatisation?
Well, I'm glad you raised that point, because if I did, I might sound a little bit defensive. But it is a really important point that we don't have a monopoly. I mean, thankfully, the vast majority of travellers are observing the guidelines, but there is a cohort who are not. And the same, as you rightly point out, you know, applies to the settled community, even those in the higher echelons of society. We all remember Govgate, you know, Supreme Court judges mm-hmm. and EU commissioners and so forth. So, look, regardless of your ethnic origin, it's not acceptable to be getting involved in large gatherings. People must observe the public health guidelines. Avoid large gatherings. Don't travel 5 kilometres beyond your home. Wash your hands frequently. Wear a mask in public places. And if people take these steps and are a lot more responsible, then we will beat this virus, and we will get back to something that will resemble something like normality.
Okay, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme this morning there, Martin Collins of Pavé Point, and condolences on the loss of your cousin. The time is 10 to 9.
There was little surprise and even less controversy when the junior certificate exams were cancelled earlier this year. The exam is no longer a defining one for the vast majority of students, and the Department of Education said the Leaving Cert exams had to be the priority. However, five schools that cater for vulnerable teens have appealed for an exception to be made for them. They say that for a very small number of at-risk students who will leave school at 16, the exam remains hugely important. Our education correspondent Emma O'Kelly has this report from Dublin's Henrietta Street School.
Okay, well, remember we looked at that man Wolfe Tone?
Yeah, he got caught at the park playing Irish boy.
In a lofty Georgian building in the heart of Dublin's north inner city, junior certificate students are learning about the 1798 rebellion. Henrietta Street School caters for 20 very vulnerable young teens, some of them rebels too in their own way. Nine students here were expecting to sit their junior certificate exams this coming June. Fergus Carpenter is principal.
Students here are boys and girls, mainly boys, aged 12 to 16. They would all have had difficulties in their previous schools due to behavioural issues in most cases, not all cases. But what they do all share is a level of social risk due to family circumstances and so on. So it wouldn't be unusual for a student to have been either homeless or to have addiction issues among siblings or parents, or premature death would be reasonably common as well, unfortunately. So they come with a fair amount of trauma in their lives.
And why is the junior cert so important for them?
Yeah, I mean, they come having, in a lot of cases, been put out of school, expelled from second level schools, or in some cases they just refused to go or couldn't manage to go to second level schools. So they come to us with that history, if you like. Our teachers do an amazing job over 2 or 3 years in helping them regain confidence in themselves as learners. And the culmination of that, I suppose, is the junior cert. It's the document that says to them, on behalf of the state, the Department of Education are saying, this is the level you've reached. You have studied, you have worked, you have gone to school, and this is the piece of paper that proves that. It's hugely important for them.
Fergus Carpenter is talking about students like Tyrese O'Farrell.
Down history, maths, business, art, and two rounds.
And what do you want to go on to do after this, Tyrese?
A mechanic or a build.
The whole talk with him really is around the junior cert. He wants to get an apprenticeship. And that is his motivation for coming back. If I had to go back into him when a final decision is made and tell him, listen, sorry about this, you'll just get a school assessment report, it's not good. I can't see us holding on to him.
So you need an apprenticeship for a mechanic, do you?
Yeah.
And if it wasn't going to be going ahead, Would you still be getting up in the morning coming in here?
No. Honestly, I wouldn't. Because, like, what's the point?
Tory Dunn and Brad Mulholland are two other Henrietta Street Junior Cert students. They told me of their future hopes and why regular school didn't work out for them.
I wanted to be an SNA, but I don't know if I want to do that because my patience can, like, I lose my patience sometimes.
And tell me about your past school. What was it that caused you problems in that school?
Too much people and just get myself into trouble.
What kind of trouble?
Couldn't sit down on a table or just do something, like stay with doing something down.
And what about here?
Way easier.
Why?
You just get more attention.
When you actually get treated like a human being in here, they have respect for you. They just listen.
The Department of Education, in a statement to RTE News, has reiterated its reasons for cancelling the exams. It cites public health concerns and the logistics of running junior certificate exams when the leaving certificate is, it says, the clear priority. The department also points out that junior cert students will get state certification based on in-school assessment. But none of this washes with Fergus Carpenter.
We're talking about probably between 30 and 35 students sitting a total of 7 subjects, only at ordinary level. In terms of demands on the examination committee, it's minuscule. They'd hardly notice it. So the minister, in one very small decision that wouldn't cost her tot and also wouldn't cost her very much money, it could really change the lives and the direction of the lives of these 30, 35 students. Our kids, their children at risk. They'll be making decisions of some sort around their future and which paths they take in life. Some of them when they leave us are not healthy paths. So we like to maximise the chances that they will make healthier choices for themselves and for society.
Students here want exams. It will be a challenge, they feel, but it's one they're up for.
Yeah, I want to do the exam. I can go get a job next year. Be a scaffolder.
Probably be hard sitting there, but it would be important to do it, because it'll get you far in life.
And that was Tori Dunn ending that report from Emma O'Kelly.
Now, anyone who's ever had a missing pet will know how worrying and stressful it can be. And last Monday, we heard from one pet owner who was particularly worried about his pet, Kaylin. Kaylin had been missing for a number of days, and John Nugent was really worried that Kaylin wouldn't be able to survive alone in the wild, or even that he could be shot, because Kaylin is a rather magnificent-looking golden eagle. John Nugent, good morning to you.
Good morning, Anya. How are you?
Well, Happy Friday. I'm grand. Happy Friday for you indeed. You found Kaylin.
I did. And you know what? Thanks for the media and everything that's done it. They helped me find him. And the amount of support I got from the radio is the amount of support from social media. And I have sightings of Ockram, Avoca, Arklow, British Bay, Coins Cross. They were, Kaylin was there. The pictures, the people have been in touch and told me he was there. And the professional people from the likes of Adair Manor, Willie Ford, kept bringing me. He said, walk the same path every day, morning and night. He'll come back. He knows where he's being fed. He's a clever bird. And yesterday afternoon, on my eighth day, there's the bird sitting on the tree where I walked the path the same morning. And there he was sitting there.
And what happened? What did you do when you saw him?
Well, I can't say a grown man crying, but I was so excited. It was unreal. So I thought he was on the tree. Now, he was slightly caught on the tree, and as Jesse saw, when I whistled up to him, he whistled back. The minute I got up, got him down out of the tree, put him on the hand, and he wouldn't release. He just held onto my hand all the way back, and everybody's saying he hasn't eaten for 8 days. I think he might have eaten, because he'd, but I got him back, and I was glad to get him up and brought him back to us, Avery.
And you sent us in a couple of pictures, John, and you know, you said about the tears. Well, all I can say is the smiles and the photographs you sent us. And even Kaylin, I mean, I can't tell much about a golden eagle's expression, but he looks a bit happy to me.
But come here, most important, thanks for everybody for helping, because I would have lost, and you've kept me focused and kept me going with all the support. An amount of people took time out of the day and walked extra fields and looked at extra trees. I was just blown away for the people. I was just really blown. And now it's, I suppose, Kaylin belongs to the people now, because they helped me find him, you know.
So how's Kaylin settling down? Have you got his tracking device back on? And
well,
you do want him training.
I put him in his Avery last night, and I walked out of the Avery. He jumped straight to the front door to see where I was going. And I went back into the Avery and sat on the ground with him for a couple of minutes while he sat on his bow perch.
He didn't want to see you go.
He just didn't want to see me going. Like, where are you going? You left me already, or...
So I know you're planning to train him to fly free, but it sounds like he doesn't want to.
Yes, I want to train him to fly. So he's already had the first flight. It was like worrying about a teenager not coming home. Is that what they say? Going out and drinking.
Oh, yeah.
He was out partying. But he's home and he's safe.
Well, that's
and
great
he
news.
He fed well and he's happy.
And actually, those pictures of yourself and Kaylin, John, we've put them up on our accounts, our social media accounts. So
I
encourage people to have a look, because the smile will cheer you up, John. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us. And the best of luck to you and Kaylin.
And thanks again for everything, okay?
Okay, good luck.
Bye.